11. We are the champions. What kind of world did we get after the Cold War? Who won this war? Who lost? And more specifically, how did the anti-communist crusade concretely affect life for billions of people today? These questions were in the back of my head as I traveled the world reporting this book. I had been raised with a certain set of answers to the questions. To say that what I learned since I started working on this project shook my faith in those answers would be a severe understatement. But rather than just reformulate the answers myself, I wanted to hear from the people who had lived through this and felt the conflict most intimately. So I put the questions directly to the survivors I interviewed in Indonesia and around Latin America. For them, the answer was usually quite simple. I asked Winarso, who is the head of Secretariat Bersama 65, or the Unified 1965 Secretariat, a threadbare organization advocating for survivors of the violence in Indonesia. The United States won. Here in Indonesia, you got what you wanted, and around the world, you got what you wanted, he said to me in 2018, sitting on the floor of his modest home in Solo, constantly shifting his weight, trying to avoid further inflaming a painful back injury. I had gotten to know him fairly well over years of interviews he helped organize. He continued, "The Cold War was a conflict between socialism and capitalism won. Moreover, we all got the U.S.-centered capitalism that Washington wanted to spread. Just look around you," he said, gesturing to his city and the entire Indonesian archipelago around him. "How did we win?" I asked. Winarso stopped fidgeting. "You killed us." Answers like that were very common. The people I met were not a random selection of the world's population. These were mostly the victims of, and experts on, anti-communist mass murder programs in the 20th century. There are important other viewpoints out there, but I'm convinced that the perspectives of people like Winarso and the experiences of people like Francisca and Carmen and Ingyak and Sakono are crucial to understanding how our world turned out. In 1955, Sukarno and much of the rest of the Third World came together with the intention of changing the relationship between the First and Third World. They believed that after centuries of racist colonialism, it was their time to take their place in world affairs as independent nations, to assert their power and intelligence and potential, and to rise as equals. Back then, they were obviously very far behind, and not just symbolically. A quick look at GDP per capita, the size of a country's yearly economic output divided by the number of inhabitants in the world's most populous countries, see Appendix 1, confirms that. The numbers for the U.S. and the economies of the white former colonial powers were far, far larger than those in the Third World. Sukarno thought this would change. Richard Wright, the skeptical African-American journalist who covered the 1955 Bandung Conference, thought the Third World movement would succeed too. Colonialism was over. Naturally, these countries would catch up. But when Winarso waved his hand around him, indicating the current state of the wider world, what was he pointing at? We kept talking about this. One thing is clear as day, even without looking at economic data or quality of life tables. The United States is still by far the most powerful nation on Earth, and when Americans travel to Indonesia or Mexico or Africa or Paraguay, they are richer than the locals. But citizens of the United States vastly underestimate the size of the gap between them and the rest of the world. The gap between the First World and Third World is enormous. The U.S. economy is not just a little bigger than Indonesia's, it is 20 times larger. Brazil's GDP per capita number is less than one-sixth the U.S. number. With very few exceptions, the countries that were at Bandung have remained in the same structural relationship to the former imperial powers. See Appendix 2. The People's Republic of China has become much more powerful. Everyone in Southeast Asia can feel that now. The Chinese economy is now nearly as big as the U.S. economy. But that's because there are four times as many Chinese people as there are Americans. China has gone from being an incredibly poor country to an average country, with GDP per capita around Latin American levels, and the Chinese people remain, on average, incredibly poor by U.S. standards. It is Chinese economic growth over the past few decades that has driven most of the reductions in global inequality that have taken place since 1980. There are heated debates as to whether China has grown because it embraced capitalism or because it had communist reforms and still remains under the control of a technocratic single party. But what is clear is that China is absolutely not an anti-communist regime created by U.S. intervention in the Cold War. One way of looking at it indicates that global inequality has gone down slightly since 1960, largely because of China, see Appendix 3. Another way of looking at it, that is, by grouping countries into regions, indicates that the Third World has been stuck where it was, while the First World has gotten even better off, see Appendix 4. There are myriad complex and unresolved debates as to why less rich countries have failed to catch up with rich ones, of course, but it's important to be conscious of the all-too-forgotten size of the gap between nations and the story of global inequality since World War II, because the events of this book need to fit into that story. One recent study asked U.S. citizens to approximate what the average human earns per year. The number they guessed was 10 times too big. They were shocked to find out just how the Third World still lives. The reality is that the White World and the countries that conquered the globe before 1945 remain very much on top, while the brown countries that were colonized remain on the bottom. Almost everyone is better off now in a concrete material sense because of technological advances and global economic growth, but the gap between the First and Third World remains about as cavernous as it was after the Bandung Conference. It would be too much to claim that this is because of the Cold War, or more specifically because of the loose network of anti-communist mass murder programs that the United States organized and assisted. But it's true that the period of the Cold War and its immediate aftermath, the period in which the U.S. made routine violent interventions in global affairs, was not marked by a drop in the power of the white countries. It is fair to say that the First World won the Cold War, and more generally, won 20th century history. This is the world that I was born into. I said in the introduction that history is usually written by the victors, and for better or worse, the same is true of this book. I was born and raised in the United States. It is probably no coincidence that it was someone with my background who was able to acquire the contacts and funding to tell this global story, rather than a woman from the Javanese countryside or resident of a Brazilian favela. What about the Second World? Over tea with an aging member of the Vietnamese Communist Party recently, this question came up. He is very open about problems with the socialist system in his country, but said that the government in Vietnam, much like in China and the rest of what's left of the socialist world, watched very carefully what happened to the Soviet Union and its satellites after 1989, and are desperate to avoid repeating those experiences. Certainly, the leaders of the communist parties who ran the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact countries lost, and lost big, but what about their citizens, the regular suffering peoples of the communist world? Did the triumph of global capitalism mean victory for them too? Were they rewarded with prosperity and democracy? Economist Branko Milanovic, one of the world's foremost experts on global inequality, born and raised in communist Yugoslavia, asked those questions on the 25th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. We can probably guess that no, they didn't all get that. But it was certainly the idea back in 1991, and in many ways it was the promise that was made to the suffering peoples of the communist world, including to Milanovic himself. What happened instead was a devastating Great Depression. Milanovic, in a short essay titled For Whom the Wall Fell, looked at post-communist countries in 2014. Some countries still have smaller economies than they did in 1990. Some have grown slower than their Western European neighbors, meaning they are falling further and further behind even from the low point in 1990 when the collapse of their system cut down the size of their economies. He finds only five real capitalist success cases: Albania, Poland, Belarus, Armenia, and Estonia, which have been somehow catching up with the First World. Only three are democracies. Which means, Milanovic calculates, that only 10% of the population of the former communist world in Eastern Europe got what they were promised when they tore the wall down. The Second World lost, and lost big. They lost the geopolitical power they had during the Cold War. Their citizens often lost material wealth, and many did not even gain democratic freedoms to counterbalance that loss. And the Third World? Of course, the country I spent the most time on was Indonesia, the world's fourth most populous country, founder of the Third World Movement, and still home to the Non-Aligned Movement, which has its offices in Jakarta. Often, when I interviewed survivors of the violence in 1965, they assumed I would want to ask them about the torture. What it was like to be beaten, to be starved, to be called a witch or devil, to lose all contact with your family, to be gang-raped and thrown into the corner of a cell afterward as if you were nothing. This was not usually what I wanted to talk about. To the extent that journalists or academics have ever spent much time asking survivors to tell their stories, they have already asked them this. Too often exclusively this, with the underlying assumption that it was only the excesses of the repression that were the problem, that if they had just arrested 2 million people, then proved in a court of law that those people were really communists and executed half of them, that would have been okay. Personally, I was happy to let the survivors just sketch the worst parts of their stories in quick terms, if it became clear that going through those moments again would re-traumatize them. Unfortunately, though, I did have to ask a question, in two parts, that often proved extremely difficult for them to answer. It took me a long time to perfect the wording of this query in Bahasa Indonesia, so as to make myself very, very clear. At least when talking to those who really had been leftists, I would always say, "Think back to 1963, 1964. In those years, what world did you believe that you were building? What did you believe the world would be like in the 21st century? Then I'd ask, "Is that the world you live in now?" Often, their eyes would light up when answering the first part. They knew the answer. They were building a strong, independent nation, and they were in the process of standing up as equals with the imperial countries. Socialism wasn't coming right away, but it was coming, and they would create a world without exploitation or systemic injustice. The answer to the second question was so obvious that it felt cruel even to ask. It might have been one thing if their government had committed horrible atrocities, but recognized the mistake and built a just, powerful society. This did not happen. They are living out their last years in a messy, poor, crony capitalist country, and they are told almost every single day it was a crime for them to want something different. If we read Sukarno's opening speech at Bandung, if we look at left-leaning publications across the world from 1955 to 1965, if we read Afro-Asian journalist, The Spirit of Bandung, pro-Third World magazine that Francisca translated, or democratic socialist publications in Brazil and Chile, we can ask, were they crazy? Were their expectations wildly unrealistic? Or could things have been different? As we have seen, in the years 1945 to 1990, a loose network of U.S.-backed anti-communist extermination programs emerged around the world, and they carried out mass murder in at least 22 countries, see Appendix 5. There was no central plan, no master control room where the whole thing was orchestrated, but I think that the extermination programs in Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, East Timor, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Indonesia, Iraq, Mexico, Nicaragua, Paraguay, the Philippines, South Korea, Sudan, Taiwan, Thailand, Uruguay, Venezuela, and Vietnam should be seen as interconnected and a crucial part of the U.S. victory in the Cold War. I am not including direct military engagements or even innocent people killed by collateral damage in war. The men carrying out purposeful executions of dissidents and unarmed civilians learned from one another. They adopted methods that were developed in other countries. Sometimes they even named their operations after other programs they sought to emulate. I found evidence indirectly linking the metaphor Jakarta, taken from the largest and most important of these programs, to at least 11 countries. But even the regimes that were never influenced by that specific language would have been able to see very clearly what the Indonesian military had done and the success and prestige it enjoyed in the West afterward. And though some of these programs were wildly misdirected and also swept up bystanders who posed no threat whatsoever, they did eliminate real opponents of the global project led by the United States. Indonesia is, again, the most important example. Without the mass murder of the PKI, the country would not have moved from Sukarno to Suharto. Even in countries where the fate of the government was not hanging in the balance, mass murders functioned as effective state terror, both within the countries and in the surrounding regions, signaling what could happen to you if you resisted. I am not saying that the United States won the Cold War because of mass murder. The Cold War ended mostly because of the internal contradictions of Soviet communism and the fact that its leaders in Russia accidentally destroyed their own state. I do want to claim that this loose network of extermination programs, organized and justified by anti-communist principles, was such an important part of the U.S. victory that the violence profoundly shaped the world we live in today. All this depends on what we think the Cold War actually was. The popular understanding in the English-speaking world, I think, is that the Cold War was a conflict between two countries, and although they didn't go to war, they engaged in a number of indirect conflicts. This is not exactly wrong, but it's based on the experiences of a small minority of people on Earth, and the Cold War affected almost everyone. I follow Harvard historian Odd Arne Westad in viewing the Cold War as something different. We can see the Cold War as the global circumstances under which the vast majority of the world's countries moved from direct colonial rule to something else, to a new place in a new global system. If we view it this way, then there is not a simple winner or loser binary between the United States and the Soviet Union. In the Third World, there were many paths each country could take. More importantly, most of them are still on the specific path that was shaped and taken during the Cold War. Something similar is true for the entire structural relationship between the rich and poor countries. The relationship we now have was largely shaped by the way both those two powers behaved in the 20th century. None of the systems set up by the Soviet Union are still here. On the other hand, the countries that chose, or were forced onto, paths into the American-led global capitalist system have stayed on them. The countries that did not often fell onto similar paths in the past 25 years. Over that same time period, the world has undergone a process often called globalization. That term certainly caught on for a while, but for those who want to be truly accurate, a better word is Americanization, Westad says. For better or worse, almost all of us now live in the global economic system that Indonesia and Brazil entered in the mid-1960s, a worldwide capitalist order with the United States as its leading military power and center of cultural production. That may change soon, who knows, but we're still here. In this book, I spent less time discussing the real atrocities carried out by certain communist regimes in the 20th century. That's partly because they're so well known already. It's mostly because these crimes truly didn't have much to do with the stories of the men and women whose lives we traced throughout the past 100 years. But it's also because we do not live in a world directly constructed by Stalin's purges or mass starvation under Pol Pot. Those states are gone. Even Mao's Great Leap Forward was quickly abandoned and rejected by the Chinese Communist Party, though the party is still very much around. We do, however, live in a world built partly by U.S.-backed Cold War violence. The establishment of Americanization was helped along by the mass murder programs discussed in this book. In a way, they made it possible. They surely weren't the only events that did so. We have not discussed all the nonviolent ways Washington forced regime change in the 20th century, nor did we analyze the reasons U.S. institutions made the country such a wealthy, dynamic, and powerful nation in the first place, but we can definitely imagine things going a different way without them. Washington's anti-communist crusade, with Indonesia as the apex of its murderous violence against civilians, deeply shaped the world we live in now in five ways. First, most simply, there is the trauma, which is mostly unresolved. Countries like Chile and Argentina did a fairly good job of coming together for national reconciliation. Brazil did a worse job, and Indonesia did absolutely nothing of the kind. But even in the best-case scenario, it's obvious you cannot simply delete the scars of mass terror in a generation or two. The psychological effects of U.S. covert action are felt everywhere, including in North America. More and more citizens there have connections to countries touched by recent U.S. interventions, and even for white Americans, there are psychological effects. When people find out that some things, important things, have been hidden from them, they start to doubt things they shouldn't and embark on wild conspiracy theorizing. Second, Washington's violent anti-communist crusade destroyed a number of alternative possibilities for world development. The Third World Movement fell apart partly because of its own internal failures, but it was also crushed. These countries were trying to do something very, very difficult. It doesn't help when the most powerful government in history is trying to stop you. It's hard to say how they might have reshaped the world if they were truly free to experiment and build something different. Maybe the countries of the developing world would have been able to come together and insist on changing the rules of global capitalism. Perhaps many of these countries would not be capitalist at all. I suppose it's possible, though it seems unlikely to me, considering who the victims were and considering the strength of the U.S., that without this violence, authoritarian socialists could have won the 20th century. It's not clear we even have the ability to imagine what could have been different. When it comes to pure economics, there is increasingly robust agreement that the developing nations lost their chances to catch up economically with the first world around the early 1980s when an explosion of debt, a turn to neoliberal structural adjustment, and globalization put them on their current path. Within the current structure, the only real examples of large third world countries becoming as rich as those in the first world since 1945 are South Korea and Taiwan. And it's very clear that these nations were given special exemptions from the rules of the world order because of their strategic importance in the Cold War. Third, the operations profoundly affected the nature of the regimes and economic systems set up in their wake. Indonesia and Brazil are two, perhaps the two crucial, examples. It's now probably broadly accurate to say that all of Latin America, with the exception of Cuba, consists of crony capitalist nations with powerful oligarchies. In Southeast Asia, the same is true for the majority of countries, and even the communist nations were integrated into ASEAN, which Indonesia and the Philippines set up as anti-communist in 1967. As The Looting Machine by Tom Burgess shows, Africa's political economy remains dominated by weak states and violent extraction. If we wanted to try to stretch this analytical focus to its limits, we could even say that when the Second World collapsed, those countries were integrated into a global system that only had two basic structural types: Western advanced capitalist countries and resource-exporting crony capitalist societies shaped by anti-communism, and they slid right into the second category, becoming very much like Brazil. In the introduction, I said that Brazil and Indonesia were probably the biggest victories of the Cold War. In a narrow sense, I figure that is true simply because, by population, they are the largest countries that came into play, which seemed like they could go either way, but then fell with a thud into the Western camp. In Brazil today, the idea that the João Goulart government was communist, or that a turn toward the Soviet model was imminent, is rightly ridiculed. But the conservatives do have a point. Something else was indeed possible, and the events of 1964 killed that possibility. But another reason that I think Brazil and Indonesia were such important elements of the process of Americanization that ultimately shaped most of the globe is that, after 1964 and 1965, so many of their neighbors landed on paths that were influenced directly or indirectly by the anti-communist regimes in the region's largest countries. As for the victors of the anti-communist crusade, it's clear that as a nation-state, the United States has done enormously well since 1945. It is an extremely rich and powerful country. But if we look at individual Americans or break down the analysis along class and race lines, it's clear that the spoils of that global ascendance were shared extremely unequally. More and more of the flows coming in from other nations have accumulated at the very top, while some U.S. citizens live in poverty comparable to life in the former Third World. The fourth way that anti-communist extermination programs shaped the world is that they deformed the world socialist movement. Many of the global left-wing groups that did survive the 20th century decided that they had to employ violence and jealously guard power or face annihilation. When they saw the mass murders taking place in these countries, it changed them. Maybe U.S. citizens weren't paying close attention to what happened in Guatemala or Indonesia, but other leftists around the world definitely were watching. When the world's largest communist party without an army or dictatorial control of a country was massacred, one by one, with no consequences for the murderers, many people around the world drew lessons from this with serious consequences. This was another very difficult question I had to ask my interview subjects, especially the leftists from Southeast Asia and Latin America. When we would get to discussing the old debates between peaceful and armed revolution, between hardline Marxism and democratic socialism, I would ask, who was right? In Guatemala, was it Arbenz or Che who had the right approach? Or in Indonesia, when Mao warned Adit that the PKI should arm themselves, and they did not? In Chile, was it the young revolutionaries in the MIR who were right in those college debates, or the more disciplined, moderate Chilean Communist Party? Most of the people I spoke with who were politically involved back then believed fervently in a nonviolent approach, in gradual, peaceful, democratic change. They often had no love for the systems set up by people like Mao, but they knew that their side had lost the debate because so many of their friends were dead. They often admitted without hesitation or pleasure that the hardliners had been right. Adit's unarmed party didn't survive, Allende's democratic socialism was not allowed, regardless of the détente between the Soviets and Washington. Looking at it this way, the major losers of the 20th century were those who believed too sincerely in the existence of a liberal international order, those who trusted too much in democracy, or too much in what the United States said it supported rather than what it really supported, what the rich countries said rather than what they did. That group was annihilated. Finally, the fifth consequence of the Crusade. Fanatical anti-communism has never really left us, even in the First World. Not only in Brazil and Indonesia in the past few years, it has become clear that this violent, paranoid style in politics remains a very potent force. But I think it's clear that the ghosts of this battle most actively haunt the countries of the developing world.